Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Bald Men on Campus, a new ESPN podcast hosted by Jay Billis, LaPhonso Ellis, and Seth Greenberg. These ESPN basketball personalities give you an all-access pass inside the world of college basketball, talking to the biggest names in the sport. That's Bald Men on Campus. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, The Book of Boba Fett is coming to Disney Plus on December 29th, but you can watch the trailer for this thrilling Star Wars adventure of the legendary bounty hunter Boba Fett and mercenary Fennec Shand. Follow the journey as the two navigate the galaxy's underworld to stake their claim on the territory once ruled by Jabba the Hutt. That's The Book of Boba Fett. Check out the trailer now on Disney Plus. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Joining us this week is when we do guests. He is the host of Slow Burn 6. His name is Joel Anderson. And I have to say, Joel from Missouri City is being a little cocky with this because we had to tape this a day early. And so it is Tuesday and he brought that Astros hat out, even though it is entirely possible that by the time the people see this, the Astros might be eliminated.
Did you say you're from Houston? Or?
Yeah, I'm from Houston.
Really? And so there's a World Series going on. There's a Houston team in it, right? Going to be playing at home. And so who are you rooting for again?
Oh, the Braves, no question. As it's been since the year 1986, and we moved to Houston in 1987.
Just proving, like I've always said, that the North Side isn't really Houston, but that's fair. Okay.
Oh, okay. That's where we go. That's where we going with. Okay. I see you got your Fire Coach University hoodie on there. Shout out to the Fired Frog, Gary Patterson.
Every school has an attraction. We have a Fired Frog with a statue. Y'all got a petting zoo down there in Austin. So,
dude, I don't even know what we could talk about associated with what's going on around the Texas Longhorn football program right now. And you know why I don't know if we can talk about it? Because I haven't seen any definitive report about whether or not this monkey actually harm somebody. Because once we find out if the monkey actually did something to somebody, now it's all wide open. We can talk about whatever. But as things stands right now, I need to know, did that monkey really like almost devour a child?
Is there not an incident report? You'd think there'd be something, like somebody would have had to call somebody if what is alleged the monkey did to a small child actually happened, right? Somebody got put in some paperwork.
Yeah, I just need to know. Speaking of paperwork, they got a permit for that monkey. Like, I just don't believe that you can just have a monkey up in your crib. Like, that's just not, that can't be it.
It's Texas, man. I mean, you can carry a gun wherever you want. Sure, you can have a monkey.
That's true. But you know why you can carry a gun? In case you got to shoot somebody's monkey. And I'm like they apparently got this monkey. What do you do with the monkey when you go out of town? Like, there ain't no monkey kennels.
Man, yeah, you can't take it to PetSmart or nothing like that. I assume that monkey, the young lady, appears to have a road show. So I imagine that where she goes, the monkey goes.
How you get the monkey there? Are you allowed to take a monkey on a plane?
Man, that's another good question. I mean, what kind of salary do you think a special teams coach at University of Texas makes?
I have been told that his salary is actually pretty significant. Like, I think that he is kind of way up on the special teams coach pecking order.
Probably afford, you know, monkey storage. That I imagine, if you got to do it, if you fly in United or Delta, you know,
yeah,
if somebody can pay for it, he's in that class of people that could pay for it, you know, if the pole assassin wants to make that happen.
Dude, I spent so much of Monday night like looking up the pole assassin and the monkey. And if you don't know what we're talking about, just Google pole assassin. And I think that'll get you to the bottom of where this is, because you know where this is really bad for Texas. This is what happens when you got two rivals. You know what I'm saying? Because you got the Aggies digging up the story, and then you got the Sooners to come dance on you when you got a story that involves a special teams coach, a monkey, and the pole assassin who has been on Jerry Springer as
it seems
the
like
pole
multiple
assassin.
Times, right? There's not just one. I feel like there's couple appearances. I feel like she was a repeat guest.
I did not know.
You saw the show. You know what I'm saying? It seemed like that's something. He was very impressed, according to the tweet that we were sharing the other night. So I assume, you know,
not,
she's just like
right?
a special guest. Yeah, bring her back. Right.
I mean, she possesses an incredible amount of core strength. Like, if there's anything that I saw from that, like, her core strength is strong. There's no disputing that. I didn't know that the Jerry Springer show was still in the league.
Me either. I mean, I was watching Jerry Springer 25 years ago. So, I mean, that's got to be one of the longest running shows on TV, right?
Dude,
I mean,
there was like a 18-month period where I don't know why, but the Jerry Springer Show was like the number one thing in television. I want to say Springer came on at 4 because we would watch Springer and then we go to the calf at 5 to get dinner because we were at that age where we ate all the time. So like 5 o'clock come around and we need food. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And we would watch Springer. And I just remember, it just felt like the most absurd day of my life. Like, I don't know what the topic was on Springer, one of the 5, because they only got like 5 like different topics, right?
Right.
And then immediately after Springer was over, it was the day that I fully understood how the local news in Atlanta got down, because the local news everywhere gets down in different places. It has little wrinkles. So like in California, the local news wrinkle, I mean, I don't know about Northern California, but I know in LA, it's car chases, right?
Absolutely.
Like they always got a helicopter up there ready for a car chase. I've never been anywhere else where they just always got car chases on the news. But the wrinkle in Atlanta is people from Atlanta. And the lead story on the news before we went out was about somebody trying to set it off at Chuck E. Cheese. They tried to run up on the Chuck E. Cheese before they opened. I think they were trying to get there like right before the armored truck, but while the money was, you know, getting prepared to come out. And yeah. I don't think it worked out very well. I'm assuming that because, in fact, they couldn't have been trying to rob the armored truck because nobody died. Like, you try to rob the armored truck, somebody's going to die.
Right. Right. You're going to shoot it out. To your point, you know, I lived in Atlanta for a couple years, and I think one of the stories that most typifies that experience was in Duluth. They had Applebee's, and it was one of them Falcons-Saints games, and people had gathered in the Applebee's to watch the game, and you know how the Falcons and Saints rivalry gets.
Yes.
You know, some people might get a little talkative. One brother from New Orleans, you know, goes out to his car, comes back, and starts capping people in the parking lot. And you can actually look this story up. If you just do Duluth, Saints, and Applebee's, you can find out what happened. But I was like, oh, okay, that's how Atlanta gets down, bro. You know?
Yo, let me tell you, talk about that, look it up. One day, I decided I was going to look up that Chuck E. Cheese story, right?
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, it was a lot harder to find than I thought because apparently, attempting to rob a Chuck E. Cheese is a bit more common in Atlanta than I had presumed. I figured that I would Google about these dudes who tried to rob the Chuck E. Cheese, and the number one entry would be that one. But over the span of the 24 years or so since that first Chuck E. Cheese robbery, others have dared to try to rob the Chuck E. Cheese. And here's the thing to me about that I'm going to rob Chuck E. Cheese thing. And I feel you. You're going to try to rob Chuck E. Cheese. It makes sense. But let me tell you who does not do the hiring at Chuck E. Cheese. Charles Entertainment Cheese. He is not the person who does the hiring. The person who does the hiring at Chuck E. Cheese is somebody in Atlanta. And you know who they hiring? People in Atlanta. And you know what that means? Somebody probably brought that thing with them to work. Especially if they heard the cats be out here trying to rob the Chuck E. Cheese.
I did not know that the Chuck E. Cheese was considered the mark, like the Jared Sorensen of restaurants or casual eateries, because who would, what about it? I mean, they got a lot of coins in there, but that just doesn't seem like you can really hit for a decent lick out of there. But maybe that's the point.
Well, I think part of the point is nobody would expect you to rob a Chuck E. Cheese, because who would do such a thing? But I do imagine, especially considering this is the 90s, so they got the money for the pizzas, but as you say, the coins, they got the money for all the stuff that's on the floor. And I got to say, this is just me, okay? Whenever you hear about somebody like robbing a bank, right? Like, yo, give me the money. They got, give me everything in the drawer. They don't really mean everything in the drawer. They just mean the bills. Like, you don't never see no reenactment of no bank robbery, and them dudes is like, give me that roll of quarters too. All them rolls of quarters. Can you imagine how tired your arms would be walking out with the haul of change from Chuck E. Cheese?
Man, look, I had a coin-operated washer and dryer as recently as 10 months ago. And getting a whole bunch of quarters is hard. Like, you got to, like, make a special, get a little bag for it or whatever. It's not easy. So imagine trying to fill a sack of quarters. You're going to have to bring some people with some real muscle with you. You know what I'm saying? Maybe a little big. It might be a little too easily identifiable if you're going to try to pull that scam.
There's been some dude out here buying everything with a handful of change, right? Like, as soon as you steal the money, man, you got to go blow it on some stuff and lay low with it, right? So you out here trying to buy whatever. Y'all go celebrate. You're going to go to the liquor store and get you a bottle of Remy the VSOP. You know what I'm saying? Paying for it with a bag of quarters and dimes.
Well, I'm saying it's kind of funny because you would steal the quarters out of Chuck E. Cheese, and I'd immediately think, all right, well, when, how am I going to use these quarters? Well, I guess I got to try to find an arcade. You know what I'm saying? But you just left the arcade. So, yeah.
They're going to track you down from the Coinstar. You're going to take your happy ass in there with all that change and pour it into the Coinstar.
I'm so hype on Double Dragon, and all of a sudden, they came in on me. Yeah.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
How in the world we got there, I don't know. The reason we have you here is Slow Burn Season 6. I believe it is debuting November the 3rd is the date, I believe.
That would be, if I have my dates right, today. We're recording.
That's why I said
Tuesday.
November 3rd. That's why I said November 3rd.
November 3rd. Okay,
just
yeah,
give
right.
Give them the yes. day. Wednesday, coming November the 3rd.
Wednesday, November 3rd. Yeah, wherever you listen to podcasts, if you listen to podcasts, it will be in that feed under Slow Burn. Yes, sir.
All right. Now, the last Slow Burn, the last one was the Al-Qaeda one, right?
Yes, right. That's the lead okay. up to the Iraq War. There you go. Yes,
got it. Sir. Okay. That one I was not have not been able to check out. The one before it, though, Josh Levin doing the joint on David Duke is an incredible piece of work. Because basically what he did was he just did a podcast on Donald Trump. It's just not about Donald Trump. It's about David Duke. But it is absolutely about Donald Trump. And it's like the moment that it hits you that that's what's going on. You're like, oh, okay. And it had the late, great Edwin Edwards. You have taken on an incredible topic here with Season 6, which is the Los Angeles. Some people call it riot. Some people call it uprising. Some people call it rebelling. Either way, it happened in 1992 after Rodney King was beaten and then the cops were acquitted. So this had to be, and I guess you're still doing it, but I mean, this has got to be just wild, daunting, and challenging. Also kind of fun.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing about it is that, I mean, for such a somber, terrible, catastrophic event, it actually is a lot of fun because it has all these different things. And like I always say, this came up when I was working on Season 3 of Slow Burn, which was about Biggie and Pac, because in Episode 2, we cover how law enforcement all around the country, but particularly in LA and South Central, just ramped up its offense against these black communities or whatever. And all of that fuels the birth and explosion of so-called gangster rap, like, you know, the police, Ice Cube, all that good stuff. And so I'm in the middle of looking at all that. I'm like, man, there's a lot of material here. Like, there's just a lot of stuff that not even that I didn't know or that's just been sort of undercovered. And in the course of doing that, I just kind of put a bookmark in it. I was like, you know what? If I ever get a chance to work on a story, a big story, because I didn't get a chance to pick the season of Biggie and Tupac. That season was already chosen and then I got to be the host. This was something that I really, really wanted to do. And, you know, I think when I picked it up, I thought also, man, you know, I'll do a lot of reporting. I'll be in and out of LA a little bit, you know, I'll be down there every now and again. And that pandemic kind of worked against me on that. But yeah, man, this is something
that hold on. Pandemic ain't stop you from running up on the white folks at their cribs, though. You think I ain't going to talk about that? Y'all took it down to South. When you down there in California, having people wouldn't answer your calls. So you had to show up at the crib.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you're right. So I did take one trip in June. I spent a lot of time in Riverside County and Anaheim County. So it wasn't really L.A., but yes, I did have to knock on a judge's door in Manhattan Beach. Not very many of us out there in Manhattan Beach. You know what I'm saying? I did not get an answer. I left a letter. And as to date, I've not heard from Judge Joyce Carlin. But if she happens to be a Right Time fan, you know, we still would love to talk to you.
Yeah, see, you got that actual, like, journalist reporter spirit about you. Because one reason I could not do the job that you can do is I get a little nervous about talking to strangers. You know what I'm saying? Like that ain't really my bag. You be at their cribs, right? Who was it, Josh Rosen daddy that tried to call the people on you?
Manhattan Beach again, too, by the way. I went to Manhattan Beach trying to get Josh Rosen because UCLA wouldn't let us talk to him. And I'm just thinking, this is regular. This is what reporting is. I get to knock on your door. Apparently, Mr. Rosen doesn't feel quite the same way. And he, I thought he was calling the police on me, but he was calling the UCLA Sports Information Director on me. But yeah, man, you know, I don't know if I find it easier to talk to strangers, but the stakes are so much lower to me. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking to somebody and somebody you care about, like, I don't know, like that just takes a lot more energy for me. But when I'm talking to somebody, I can just kind of go into autopilot. But I got a lot of experience with that. I mean, I'm an introvert by nature, but this part of it helps me to learn how to, you know, deal with folks. And I was raised as an only child. So all this, so I don't know what it is about this field that really appealed to me, but I just get to go to people's houses or call them on the phone and they'll tell me stuff about their life. And like, that's the part of writing and journalism that I really still enjoy.
Yeah. So part I think about though, is that like 2021, people don't just knock on doors like that no more. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like people don't knock on doors like that no more. You don't get phone calls from people that you don't know who it is, because you don't answer it if you don't see it. Like, I'm trying to imagine now, if you knocked on my door and it turned out that you were just a reporter, I'd be like, oh, woo. Man, and it ain't about me, it's about something else. Oh, okay, right. All right. Don't come inside, though, we're going to talk about it on the poach.
Right. Nah, man, you know, you're right. Like, I mean, I can't think of the last time somebody random just showed up at my door. Actually, somebody tried to sell me a newspaper subscription a year and a half ago, and it was a scam, because I never did get that paper, but whatever, I'll let that brother make it. But yeah, man, I love, you know, knocking on doors, and it is discombobulating. Like, I feel like that's one way to sort of disarm people when you show up at their home. Maybe their guard is up initially, but if people see that you're willing to make the effort to meet them where they are, surprisingly, people will be willing to talk to you. I'm not that kind of person. If you showed up to my house and said you want to talk about something, I'd be like, show me a business card, give me an email, and I'll do some research and I'll get back to you. But more often than not, thank God, people will welcome me in and let me talk to them.
So how's the process work for something like this? Like, once you start, because this is a broad topic, the LA riots of 1992. Okay, so how do you start something like this?
Well, in terms of storytelling, the start was really easy for us. Like, it was the Rodney King beating and George Holliday filming that beating. Like, that was real easy to get our arms around it. And so we're still making storytelling choices, but we're probably going to end, you know, right at the tail end of the riot. So to me, there was sort of like a defined timeline, even though there's all these other impacts and all these other things that happened after. Like, there was a mayoral election, there was a presidential election, all these other things. But in terms of storytelling, that part of it was easy. But in terms of like what to read, what to watch, all the things I had to consume to get my heads around it, I mean, man, I wish I could show you my desk here. I've got like 20 books here, like 10 in Kindle that I've had to read, all these articles. People have all these different, you know, accounts of like what happened that day. And it's really, really overwhelming, but it's a lot of fun. Like, I never thought I would enjoy reading the Daryl Gates autobiography. You know what I mean? Like, I had to order a Playboy with a Daryl Gates interview from 1991. You know, that sort of stuff. Like, that stuff is like, just the feeling of discovery is really interesting to me. I had this perception and this idea of what happened during that particular time in Los Angeles, and reading about it confirm some of those priors, but also just was really insightful to hear how people experience it for themselves too.
Well, I was actually thinking about that, because with the riots hit, I think you were in like eighth grade, right? I was in seventh grade when this happens.
What grade were you in again?
I was in the seventh grade.
Okay. So I would have either been, or are you talking about the riots, or are you talking about the tape?
The riots.
Okay, there you go. Then you're right. I was in eighth grade then. All right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so it's interesting for me, like I found when we did like the OJ revisiting, for example, where we were both at an age where we were obviously children, but we didn't fully understand that, right? Like, we thought we got what was going on. This seemed, you know, it's got to be, I think I'm just curious about what it is like for you going back on these things that you did live through, but probably didn't fully understand at the time, right? Like the discovery process you talk about.
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, there's a few things that happened. LA had a black mayor at the time, Tom Bradley, and him trying to get his arms around what was essentially an unaccountable militaristic force within his own city is like a dynamic that is familiar to all of us now. Like, if we read the news and we see like how politics work at local levels, even nationally, like if you just want to sort of draw a parallel to President Obama and like trying to convince, you know, white people to do things or trying to assert your authority and them being like, nah, you ain't really in charge though. Like, there's a lot of that kind of stuff, that sort of sense of discovery. And another thing, I mean, to be honest, I mean, you know, we talk about Rodney King all the time, but what really stuck in my mind from that time was the Latosha Harlan shooting, man. And I don't know if a lot of people know about that, but it was a 15-year-old girl. She was shot by a convenience store owner in South Central Los Angeles in the back of the head for allegedly, the woman accused her of stealing orange juice. That's not what happened. But like, to viscerally see these things, like the beating of Rodney King, the shooting of Latasha Harlins, that always really left an impression on me. I was like, is that how the world works for real? Like, you could just get killed as a 15-year-old? Somebody can pull out a gun and shoot you in the back of the head and nothing really happened to you? Or the police can surround you and beat you up like that on camera and nobody really seems to pay a price for it? Although, later they did. But yeah, it just, that part of it, that sense of discovery, reading about all that stuff and how these things happened and the buildup to it. I didn't know any of that stuff. But how would we have, Bo? I mean, you know what news consumption was like back then? Like, if it was really big, it hit, what, 2020 or 60 Minutes? But, I mean, nationally, it wasn't that big a deal. So, like, there was no way for us to sort of know what the LA Times and KTLA and all these other people were saying about those things at the time. And, like, that part of it is, like, really interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think when the verdict came down, you and I had not lived long enough to entertain the possibility that there might be an acquittal, right? This didn't seem like a trial that required I follow it, right? Like, I didn't know what the day-to-day was.
Well, what did you think? Because, I mean, you grew up so different from other folks, right? Like, your folks are, like, in the movement folks. So, I mean, I can only imagine, like, what their response was to it, like, this is America. You know what I mean? I just imagine.
I got to be careful saying what my daddy's response was when all that stuff broke out. Let's just say there was an understanding of the anger from the patriarch of the Jones household. But I never thought that there was a way in the world. Like, there was a tape. It was right there. And, like, you know, and I think in my thoughts on this time, I did not realize as it happened, because I was too young as it happened to fully get, like, the impact of the police when it came out. Because it comes out in 1988, right? And I guess to me, the idea of police brutality had always felt ubiquitous. Like, it's just something that, you know, went on. I thought that we just kind of knew about this. I didn't really have a grasp on how that, for a whole different generation, let people know, hey, you know, they were out here beating people up. And then that made 92, it made 88 seem like prophecy, even though it was just kind of, nah, this is how stuff is all the time.
Right. You know, it's interesting because you grew up one way with a certain group of folks. And I grew up with, you know, folks that, I don't know how to say it, but they're children of the Jim Crow South. So they're skeptical of the police. But they also kind of, like, as a kid, I'm thinking, well, you know, they're saying F the police or whatever, but, and police probably are bad, but, you know, those are the kind of dudes they would be with the police. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's an interaction that they've, a bargain that they've already made by the lives they're living. I'm thinking this at, like, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, because I'm like, why would the police just beat people up for no reason? You know, right. I didn't have a better understanding of the world. And it's not like my parents had either the language or even necessarily the experience. Like, to them, they just grew up in a world where all white people were bad and police were just some of them. You know what I'm saying? But not the police in particular. And that's something that you had to learn on your own. And so, like, the video and the subsequent riots for that were, like, sort of revelatory. Then you understand that music because, like, you know, I don't know about you, but at that time, like, Ice Cube was probably my favorite rapper. Like, up until Bootlegs and B-Sides, like, he probably was my favorite rapper, solo rapper. And, like, we had to tear this up, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was, like, one of my joints. And I was like, okay, now I understand the rage. But, like, F the Police didn't hit me in quite the same way until, like you said, we saw that video and we saw the trial and we're just like, oh, wait a minute. This system is kind of really messed up.
Yeah, it's like, oh, y'all mean it. Like, yes. this ain't just something for y'all to say. Like, oh, wait, you guys, like, there's a serious level of animus here between you and the local law enforcement operation.
Yeah, there's a legitimate reason. And did you watch the NWA biopic a few years ago?
Yes.
And they had the scene. Well, I can look at your face. You must not enjoy it that much.
It's not that I didn't enjoy it, right? But there was just stuff in there. They were like, time, what is time? Yes, someone is going to be at this NWA concert in 1988 with a Rodney Hampton Giants jersey on. Never mind that Rodney Hampton didn't get drafted until 1990. it's that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. But then, you know, you see that scene when they're a group with the police. And I'm like, oh, they actually experienced some of this. I was like, I get it. It wasn't just, you know, I think like CB4, which was a take on, you know, sort of the NWA and West Coast gangster stuff. Like, you're thinking, oh, this is just for to sell albums. Like, they didn't really experience this. They're just whatever. But no, like a lot of young black men, particularly at that time, particularly in L.A., they actually did have this experience with police. And so it means, hearing that music today, it even sounds different to the ear. I'm like, okay, they're actually talking about some stuff that, like, they really experienced, you know?
I would also note, though, the story behind what made them do the police is awkward for me because apparently they were riding around shooting at people with paintball guns, just running up on people, at which point the cops ran up on them. And on a scale of 1 to 10 of egregious police behavior, that's left to 5, right? I mean, you know, that's y'all was kind of tripping, you know?
Yeah.
I'm glad you were able to channel that and to actually make a coherent statement. But if right. it had started out with me and the homies riding with the paintball, it would not have gone over the same way.
Right. I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, maybe by today's verbiage, the way we think of it, maybe we would have liked to have seen community intervention and that the police didn't have to be involved and we can do some sort of restorative justice within the community. But yeah, I was like, hey, man, y'all know y'all were tripping, though. You know what I'm saying? Somebody was going to have to stop y'all from doing that because y'all wasn't going to just realize it was wrong all on your own.
So in going through the story and like the riots themselves, I'm curious how much you guys plan to or have been able to get into just the levels of segregation in Los Angeles. Because I know one detail that people from L.A. bring up about the riots that is always worth noting, which is cops lining up along I-10. Along Interstate 10 running east-west through L.A., which is the line in L.A. Those are the tracks, for lack of a better term, in Los Angeles. And the cops lining up to make sure wherever the damage took place, it was not going to happen north of the 10.
It's over there, right? You know, we could definitely get into some of that. I mean, one of the things that, like, and I don't know if I'll even, all the information that I have, I can't put it all into the podcast. But, like, for instance, like Watts, you know, in the 20s, 30s, a white neighborhood. You know, that was a white area, right? As soon as these black folks come from the South trying to find, you know, LA, you know, trying to free themselves of the shackles of the Jim Crow South, and they start moving into Watts where there's more affordable housing, and they're thinking about municipalizing, like having their own government, LA annexes them, brings them in because no, there's no way that black people should be able to govern themselves, right? So yeah, we get a lot into that and like how South Central ended up the way that it did. That's not by accident. Like, that's where people were redlined into those neighborhoods. And as a result, it made it easier for the police to keep up with them and to police them and to put their resources there. And you have all this stuff going on for years and years and years. Just black folks just taking this stuff, you know, being isolated from the wealthier parts of town, isolated from resources. They're over-policed. And so, yeah, like, segregation is a story in every town in this country. Like, there's not, I always say, because I used to be a reporter when I would go out all the time, and I'd be, no matter where you go in this country, from Seattle to Key West, there's some black people mad about how the white people in their town are treating them. But mm-hmm. it is very much a piece of this story about how the segregation really exacerbated a lot of the tensions here, because eventually their segregation bore the fruit, and a lot of that was those, you know, unrest, you know, and all those other things that went on. So, yeah.
Did you, in the course of your research, come across this book called City of Quartz?
Yes, Mike Davis. Yes.
Okay. I never got to the end of City of Quartz. I read about half of it, right? It's excellent. I just, one of those that I just did not get to the end of.
Oh, where they talk about people moving out to the desert and starting communities and stuff like that?
Yeah.
That's early in the book. But yes. It's a great book.
There are two things that stuck out about that book. It's kind of a neo-Marxist look at the building of Los Angeles, right? But two observations I took from it that'll always stick with me. One is that LA is just a collection of gangs. It's a collection. Everybody came there from these far-flung places, and they click up with whoever the people are and whatever level it was. Like, gang life in Los Angeles makes a lot more sense when you realize everybody else is a gang. It just don't sound like it because it's like the Armenians, the Guatemalans, yeah. the Jews, the people who work here, the people. You understand what I'm, you know.
The Koreans, yeah. Just
right.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so black people who have left their family structures, everything else, don't have anything institutional to lean on. And what brings them together, black is a little bit flimsy when you think about it as an actual tie that binds. And so, yeah, gangs pop up. You would expect that. But the other thing I'll never forget about that book that I did not realize about California was L.A. was sold by pamphlet. Like, the growth of Los Angeles came back in the days where they would put advertisements in magazines and send out pamphlets and stuff about, come check out this place. And people really would pack up all their and move based on what they had been reading in these advertisements in magazines. Like, when you watch commercials, like, it's better in the Bahamas commercials they used to run back in the day. Not to go vacation, though. People would watch it, like, doing that and then moving. But they told the white people it wasn't no black people there. That was a huge selling point is that California and Los Angeles specifically was an all-white paradise. That you're going to get out here, it's going to be beaches, it's going to be palm trees, it's going to be all these things, and it's going to be no black people. That's why all these people move from the Midwest, like Beverly Hills 90210. We moved from Minnesota to L.A. Hell, the Minnesota Lakers moving from there to L.A. Like, that was the story. And then you can't do nothing like that and think we not about to show up. We heard about it too.
Right. Right. We like sunshine. We like temperate climates. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
All this land.
Right. And that's where that part in The Warmth of Other Suns, to me, the most heartbreaking part of The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson is when old buddy's trying to get that room in Arizona. He moving from Atlanta to drive all the way across there to move to LA. And he gets to Arizona and nobody will give him a room. And he comes to this one hotel and the guy says, look, I would love to give you a room. I'm from Illinois. I see things differently than these people do down here. But if I give you a room, they're going to put me out of business. But I need to tell you something. I went to USC, and what you think you're going to is not what you're going to.
Yeah,
and that's what
yeah.
happened to all these black people. Like they moved on a promise that was reasonable because they're like, we're getting out the South. Everything going to be okay, right? No.
Right.
No, it
right.
won't.
And maybe there was a little bit more freedom of movement. Maybe there was an opportunity at property ownership that they did not have back home. But yeah, the fundamentals were basically the same, you know? Yeah, was that Dr. Foster? That's the guy we're thinking of. That came from Monroe, Louisiana. Yeah, man. I mean, so it's funny you said that about the way that they sold it as a white man's paradise. Because, yeah, I mean, one thing that comes up over and over again is that through, you know, maybe the 30s, people called California, Los Angeles in particular, Iowa on the Pacific, right? All those people from the Midwest, it's very conservative culture, but all these people that wanted to avail themselves of the climate and all these new opportunities or whatever. And yeah, as soon as black people show up, it's not quite as cool. And then, I mean, just think about the immigration from in 1965, the migration of Mexican immigrants into the country. Like, we were ruining their paradise, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, those white people, we didn't sign up for this. We could have stayed in Iowa. We didn't want to be around black people, you know?
They would trade the beach for the snow if we wasn't there.
Right. Yeah. We didn't want that. And so, like, that is a part of how LAPD is empowered to, like, wield this power over people. Because they're like, hey, man, you better get these brown people under control. I ain't signed up for all this, bro. And they were so fortunate that they had people in the visage of Bill Parker, who is a legendary policing figure. Like, I don't know if, Bomani, do you think people know what Dragnet is anymore? Like, that's too old.
No, they don't.
That's, yeah.
Man. We're old.
I mean, we are
old. How about
old.
This? How about this? The Dragnet movie, which was at the time about the old TV show, is now the old Dragnet movie.
Oh, God. Yeah, man. I mean, we're just, Dragnet was a very popular, one of the most popular TV shows in the 50s and 60s, and it springs from the mind of Bill Parker, who was the LAPD chief for 16 years, from 1950 to 1966, and it did a real great job in selling. The LAPD is like this very noble organization, people that protect and serve, and Bill Parker is also the person that came up with the term the thin blue line, right? So there's this real belief that, like, hey, if not for us, if not for LAPD, these hordes of brown and black people are going to come get y'all, bro. And so they empowered him to do a lot of bad things to preserve that image of LA that everybody had been sold in the first place.
Right. And then the police chief in the 90s and well before that, Daryl Gates,
his
OG is Bill Parker.
Yes.
And I think in line with what I was telling you for City of Quartz, OG is the right term to use. But that's where Daryl Gates got his game. And the LAPD, I think if people saw a lot of this stuff in the O.J. Made in America film that Ezra Edelman did, but it is worth noting that they weren't just looking for police officers to deal with all the black and brown people. They were specifically recruiting in the South to get officers, honestly, who had the spirit that was necessary for what they were asking.
So in at least, and I don't want to credit this too much, but like there were at least two accounts I've heard, read and one heard, that Bill Parker himself recruited officers from KKK meetings in the South. You know what I mean? So like anybody you ask, like people will waffle on whether or not Daryl Gates is racist or whatever, right? With, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. We can talk about the impact, right? Bill Parker, people don't waffle on that. They're like, no, that dude was a that dude was a stone cold racist. The only person that doesn't agree, at least publicly, is Daryl Gates, okay? Because that reflects poorly on him, right? But yeah, I mean, that's the kind of mentality them folks had, man, that they did that. And the impact of the LAPD, I can't emphasize enough, on the rest of the policing profession has been tremendous. Like, they sent people out. People that worked under Bill Parker went on to become police chiefs in Dallas and Fort Worth, Beverly Hills, Pasadena. many of his other deputies spread out all across the country. So the LAPD style of policing has been nationalized, really, you know, in the last half century or whatever. And a lot of it comes from Bill Parker and Daryl Gates, who, like you said, Daryl Gates was, I guess, it was his little homie. What's, you know, you got your OG, you got your little homie, and that's who Daryl Gates was.
Yeah, no, like there's so much to this. Like, I almost like talking about like the riots themselves just almost feels secondary, right? Because that's just a thing. And like the aftermath, of course, though, and I think is the cruelest part that gets lost in this is after all that stuff burned down, with nobody there to do no rebuilding, there was no empathy offered, no understanding of any of that stuff. Like, and what I don't know about LA because I don't know it well enough, but like you can go to Miami and go to places where after the McDuffie riots in 1980. You can see they're there and ain't nothing happened, right? Like they look just like they did 40 years ago when that went down. And LA, and I feel like in a lot of places, it never came back because nobody wanted to put in the work to do it.
It fundamentally changed. I will say I went to LA for the first time in my life when I was a freshman in college to visit a friend. And we took a road trip down with, you know, some of our boys. We went down from Stanford to LA. And I remember this is what, 97? Yeah, 97. So LA, like in those parts we're talking about, total like devastation. Like it looked like the fires had just started, you know, going out. Somebody had just put it out. And I know that like there have been some improvements. I mean, LA has very expensive real estate. So, you know, things have changed a little bit. But fundamentally, in terms of the people in the communities, that was ruined forever as a result of this. And I, you know, it's funny you said that, Bo, because if you go back to the 65 Watts riots, there was a real effort to try to address some of the wrongs and some of the conditions. Like they came up with programs, jobs programs, put money into it, started a community theater, all that stuff. But people didn't have like the passion or there were no resources to sustain it. And so it fell apart and they were like, well, man, what a waste of time. So you could see that certainly influencing what happened in 92 and 93 when they like, well, I'll give these people money anyway. It's going to go to waste. We don't really want to do this anyway. And so people can just sort of walk away from it.
Now, are there some figures that you came across in your research that you were just unaware of before starting this? Like, you know, kind of like my man was named Chico Del Rey in the...
Chico Del Rey. Yeah, my boy.
Yeah. So have you come across anybody like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are a couple. Man, I'm trying to say, do I want to say who it is? Well, I mean, one thing about it is like Rodney King's family to me was a total mystery. And like the people that hung out with him. And I think we talked about this a little bit before that like Rodney King was a joke to us growing up, that he was kind of set up as like a comedic figure. You know, can we all just get along? And he didn't seem very bright and all that stuff. He wasn't, you know, necessarily the most articulate on the mic, right, at that time. So people made a joke of him. It was real easy to do that. But for us, what I wanted to do was humanize him. Like, I was like, let me revisit this and talk to the people that are close to him. And I mean, like learning about him has been sort of revelatory. Like it's funny to say, you asked me, have I learned about people? And there's a lot of others, like so Latasha Harlan's family, like that story, like revisiting that is like terrible. But the discovery process of learning about Rodney King and the people that were around him that tried to help him hold it together after the beating, to me, was like I was learning about a new person, essentially. Because there's the guy that got beat on camera, the guy that was a joke, the guy that was on celebrity rehab with Dr. Drew, you know, about 15 years ago. But like learning about who he was, how gentle he was, how troubled he was. And I don't mean that it's like to levy judgment against him, but to say that like he really had a very difficult life before and after the beating. So like just like learning about him on that, like that was like the big deal for me. But there's, you know, plenty of other people that have popped up. The people that I spoke to that helped to put the tape on CNN and help the story blow up. Like, you know, you don't even think about people like that when you're growing up because there's no reason this would have been a national story at the time. But there are people that were in place that helped it to become a national story. And we talked to a lot of them. And yeah, man, it's just... we're not done, but my, that's the thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no trophy to give out right now. I'm not done. I'm at that finish line. There's still people to talk to, but that piece of it has been really, really fun, like, in revelatory, learning about, you know, the people that you think we know a lot about, but that don't actually.
You know, that thought about Rodney King being a joke, I hadn't really given that a lot of thought until you mentioned it right there, because it's funny. The Ice Cube line that, I mean, objectively speaking, might be one of the best Ice Cube lines ever. So Charlie Manson, I pull him out of truck, hit him with a brick, and I'm dancing.
Yeah. Yeah. And we know that's a terrible line, but we were like, yo, that went though. I was like,
yo, but here's the thing though. Yeah. That part where you said right there, we know that it's a terrible line because it's obviously a takeoff of Reginald Denny hashtag white Reggie being pulled out of his truck, right? And when we talk about Reginald Denny getting beat and that line comes, we're like, oh yeah, no, terrible line. We never recoiled in any way in talking about Rodney King after he was beaten by the state. Like, we asked questions about whether or not he had it coming, or we don't know what happened before the tape, but we all know, hey, what happened to Reginald Denny was messed up. Everybody gonna lead with that. And it was a judgment call on whether you led with that about Rodney King.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe in part of it is that we've just come to accept that, like, the police get that sort of impunity, that they can beat the hell out of us, and that that's the way of the world. And to see, like, black people respond in that way, like, I think we're acculturated to the idea that black people are supposed to be forgiving and not raise a fuss, and we're supposed to accept racism on the chin and keep it moving. And, like, that happened to Reginald Denny is not the example of that, and that was jarring to people, that black people might get mad. That has always been the fear of, like, black rebellion or whatever. And so, yeah, it was really, really jarring. And it was jarring to Rodney King. Like, Rodney King, who got his ass beat, like, that's why he was moved to say something in the first place, because he was like, man, that was wrong what y'all did to Reginald Denny, the dude who got beat. You know what I'm saying? So it was a real inflection point in the way people even viewed the uprising, and whether or not you think of it as, like, a remorseless, stupid bloodletting, or, like, a rebellion of people that had been oppressed for far too long.
Yeah, you know, that was like, hey, man, come on, dog. He was just trying to, he clearly doesn't want to be here.
I mean, you know, so there's been a lot of talk about that, right? And, like, Rodney King actually did, bro. I mean, can I say this? I'm going to go ahead and say it. I talked to his brother yesterday, like, literally yesterday. And that was the first time I got his brother on the phone. He was like, man, Rodney wasn't even really that mad at the cops. He said after it was all over, he said he wasn't even really mad. He was more mad about the Reginald Denny thing, and he was more mad about the cops getting off. But, like, after the ass beating, he was just like, you know, I mean, you know, I forgive people. That was the Rodney King thing. And he really did want to speak to people about it. And it just kind of came out a little weird. They gave him a prepared speech and he threw it away and did his thing, which actually, you know, has resonated far longer than anything he probably would have said in a prepared statement that day.
Yeah, it resonated more, but, like, don't nobody take Rodney King's "Can we all get along" as a mantra for us to follow. People laughed. Like, yo, he just caught the L at every turn. He tried to unify the city. We was like, I mean,
can so we all get along?
No.
Yeah, so many more of us were on the Ice Cube tip than on the Rodney King tip. You know what I'm saying? It's like, hey, man, at that time, there was a rumor, maybe we were just coming up with rumors, where, you know, people had said Reginald Denny rolled his window down and was calling people the N-word and stuff. You know, it was that kind of, like, misinformation.
No, he wasn't.
Going on to justify when it happened. And it was like, nah, that's not quite what happened, bro. Sorry,
let me tell you something. If Reginald Denny had actually done that, I might have to give him some props for being the bravest man in the world, right? Like, or he must have already concluded, I am going to die tonight. Like, you must have made that decision before, if you had actually done that, right? And he probably rolled down his window and said, Tommy don't want y'all to wear his clothes. How
about Timberland?
That?
Right. You know what I'm saying? Timberland don't want your business neither. Man. But, you know, that, I mean, of course, that was all of us just trying to come up with the reason to make it less terrible. Like, maybe he deserved it, but nah, not quite. But yeah, you make a great point, man, that, like, not a lot of people evaluated. Like, we made a joke of Rodney King getting his ass beat. Ralph Wiley, somebody we both, you know, really admire. I remember reading one of his essays as a kid, and he talked about that, like, the way that people responded to Reginald Denny. And it was just like, did y'all just miss what happened to Rodney King? You know, like, why are you so outraged about this and not Rodney King? And that's still a good question to ask even to this day.
Hey, man, so how many episodes are we going to have by the end of this?
So we got 8, and we're going to drop them every Wednesday. And every Wednesday, in addition to that episode, there'll be a Slate Plus bonus episode with me and the producer, Jason DeLeon. We'll be talking about what happened behind that episode, and then there'll be an interview. And I guess I can go ahead and say, like, the first one that comes out today, we'll have our interview with George Holliday, who recorded the tape. And he actually died. I mean, man, you know, we had to have had one of the last interviews with him because he died of COVID just in September. But we talked to him for like 2 hours. And so that'll be on one of the Slate bonus episodes that comes out November 3rd.
You going to catch up with Reginald Denny and play Natural Born Killers for him?
Man, come on, man. Reginald, look, if you too are a Right Time listener, I would love to talk to you. We have not got that far in the process yet, but just know that I'm looking for you, my brother. Yeah, I'm not going to play no Natural Born Killers for him.
Dog.
Ice Cube's politics kind of, I mean, in retrospect, I mean,
pull him out the truck, hit him with a brick, and I'm dancing. Yeah, it was bro. The dancing that was just like, I mean, of all things.
And wait, but money, bro did dance. Do you remember it was just like,
I know.
I'm ashamed for thinking that was dope.
I'm trying to imagine what it had to be like just being like a regular black person living in LA who, while bothered, did not feel like burning things, right? like, what are you, like, I remember my daddy, like, so my parents are of similar sensibilities but different temperaments, right? So my mother attended the March on Washington. My father thought it was a bit of a sellout. They had not met by this time, just to be clear.
Okay.
My pops thought it was a bit of a sellout move to be asking a man for permission and then go up there. You know what I'm saying? So, like, there's always levels in how everything goes. But when these cats is out here burning it down, and you mad, but you like, nah, man, that ain't really my bag. You know what I'm saying? That's not really what I'm going to do, sucker.
I know, right. Well, when am I going to get my groceries? You know what I'm saying? Where am I get my groceries now?
Right. Who's the black person in the neighborhood that's the equivalent of, if y'all protest on the freeway, how I'm supposed to get to work? Because they there.
Oh, it's not an insignificant number of folks, too. You know, I mean, and we've talked to some folks and read about some folks that, yeah, like there were a lot of people that were like, nah, that was crazy, though, for real. Nah, y'all need to do all that. And I guess reasonable people can disagree.
Yeah, let me tell you what I found, though, of folks from L.A. of a certain age, especially if they was teenagers at that time. Let them tell it. All of them came up on free stuff, right?
Oh,
it's kind of like the first episode of the Boondocks where Grandpa is pretending like he was out here participating in the movement.
Yeah.
And in reality, he had left to go get his raincoat.
Yeah, it's like, also, it's like people that were like at the Wilt Chamberlain 100-point game. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, man, I copped everything, bro. I got a Sega Genesis. I got some new Jordans, you know what I'm saying? We've got some bread, all of that, you know? And so it's like, nah, I don't. I mean, shoot, I'm going to say, actually, in terms of the black folks we've spoken to, I'm going to say all of them, one way or another, say that they copped something. During the unrest. I can't verify that for sure, but they say they did.
Wow. And one thing I didn't get to, because we're running out of time, but I imagine there must be some exploration of the interaction between the Afro-Americans and our Asian brothers and sisters.
Yeah, man, that hits in episode 2, because that's dealing with the Latasha Harlins episode. And I think I made reference to it a little bit earlier, but yeah, we're going to be getting into that. Really uncomfortable conversation, something that is still resonates today, right? Is marginalized communities trying to find a common cause and figure out how we're going to make our way in this country. So, yeah, man, we had to talk about that. And it's really, I mean, like I said, it turned out to be timely. I didn't plan it this way, but it turned out to be timely.
All right, man. That is Joel Anderson, Slow Burn, Season 6, available right now, wherever you get your podcast. I'll tell you, all that representing, it could
Northside ain't really Houston. Northside ain't really.
That's how y'all are, boy. That's how y'all are. You from a city that ain't even called Houston. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Gabe Bassain, Dave Presley, handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for letting me slide there, Joel, because I know what you want to say, but it would not be factual if you did. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you're a hater like Joel. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.